The following program for blind and print-impaired listeners is a production of the North Carolina Reading Service. And it is the Indie Week, the Independent, and it's a weekly publication. I'm John Feddersen here to read it to you. This particular issue, dated June 14th, of 2024. Now, Juneteenth is about to be celebrated. In fact, it began some places in June the 10th, and it goes to June 19th. And the Indie Week has provided a guide to various places in the Triangle area celebrating Juneteenth. And I'll begin to just list as many of them as I have time for. The City of Raleigh presents a 10-day celebration at John Chavis Memorial Park, featuring free events commemorating African-American culture through history, entertainment, and more. Let's see. So then that's all week at John Chavis Park. Now, let's see. This issue here that you're going to hear the first time will be on Friday, so that I won't read anything for Thursday. Let's see. Going on. Juneteenth celebration in Hillsborough, Orange County, kicking off at various locations. And it aims to explore connections to land, body, and spirit through activities that encourage reflection, empowerment, and community building. In Hillsborough, the Eno Arts Mill at 6 to 9 p.m. Friday evening. Evening will include musical offerings by Shambo Medina and DJ Complex. There's a vendor market and youth of all ages. And it says, come by, show us what your joy is all about. Now, this is, again, Friday, the 14th of June. Also Friday night, the North Carolina State Museum of Art, its third annual concert at the Bryan Amphitheater in the Museum Park. Performances by Grammy-winning gospel music Kirk Franklin and gospel artist Morette Brown Clark. You can purchase tickets by going to the North Carolina Museum of Art website. That is Friday, June 14th at 7:30 p.m. Then how about another event at Carolina Pines Park? That's ages 18 and older can celebrate there at from 8 to 10 p.m. Juneteenth celebration at the Pines. Musical performances and sing-alongs. An educational piece on the holiday's history and its current representation in the local community. Friday and Saturday, Wake Forest. It's a two-day event which is free, multiple locations, and features a community gathering with giveaways, a walking parade, presentation about renowned sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois, and more. There is a schedule at indieweek.com. For Juneteenth, which you can see if you need to list all of the places to go. Then there is for Juneteenth for the Souls of Black Folks is June 15th, Saturday. A meditation and yoga session is North Carolina Central University School of Law. There are tickets which you need to get. You go to NC Central's website. Meditation and yoga session. That's 10 to 11 a.m. on Saturday morning. Rollsville and Wake Forest, June 15th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Mill Bridge Nature Park. Live performances, family activities, etc. Now, Mordecai, the downtown reconstructed plantation buildings in Raleigh, Juneteenth is Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Head to Mordecai Historic Park, right downtown Raleigh. Historic games, crafts, workshops on oral history and African-American genealogy. Over in Garner, that is June 15th. Again, Saturday, 11 a.m. The Garner Performing Arts, excuse me, that's Friday, hang on. No, we're on Saturday, June 15th. Garner, the theme of education as freedom is the Garner Performing Arts Center. They will house choirs, speakers, educators, and others. It looks like some of that will be inside, which is handy because the temperature is going to be in the 90s for most of these daytime activities. Education and Freedom. Black Arts Festival, 11 to 4 in Pittsboro. That's at the Chatham County Fairgrounds. Music, performances, visual art, and more. And you could probably look for Chatham County Fairgrounds website to see how to reserve tickets for attending that event. Now, the Capital City, again, Saturday, noon to 6 p.m. in Raleigh. Bring lawn chairs and blankets over to Harvey Hill out at Dorothea Dix Park for this free event. Musical performances, food vendors, children's activity, other family-friendly activities, noon to 6, and down at Dorothea Dix Park. They usually have a good amount of parking available there, too. And Carrie's Juneteenth celebration, 1 through 7 p.m. That's the downtown Carrie Park. Live music, food trucks, vendors, etc., etc. 1 to 7 p.m. on Saturday. Then we have a house music and the screening of the movie, The Color Purple, which is at the North Carolina Museum of Art, Raleigh, 5 to 8 p.m. on evening of live house music and that screening at the Joseph Bryan Theater in Museum Park. Go to the North Carolina Museum of Art for ticket details. Bragtown in near Durham, June 15th, 2 to 6 p.m. afternoon. Community Association presents this event with Lakeview Park. That's where that is, 2 to 6 p.m. Now we're at Sunday, Chapel Hill Carborough celebration at the Hargraves Community Center. And you can transcribe hundreds of recorded interviews from current and former residents of historically black neighborhoods in Chapel Hill Carborough, a chalk mural, and a kids' zone. Some interesting little twists on the standard available cultural and educational things to do. This is June 16th, Chapel Hill Carborough, at 2 p.m. There, Durham, on June 16th at 3 to 8, Black Vegan Street Market. That's at Durham Central Park, and that's free. Stagville, Durham, on June 17th is 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Historic Stagville. That's a state home to one of North Carolina's largest plantations. Learn about slavery and freedom. You can view original slave quarters at Horton Grove in remembrance of those who were enslaved. Historic Stagville. They don't list any admission, or I'm sure this is a free presentation. Donna Washington, a Durham-based author and performer, will bring stories from African-American and African traditions to life, like the African trickster Anansi, at this family-friendly event at the Chatham County Public Library. That's June 17th in Pittsboro, 2 to 4 p.m. Then, let's see, June 18th, 5:30 to 8 p.m., a Juneteenth celebration of creativity, technology, and community. It's an expert-led panel discussion at the American Underground. Experience the launch of Synthesize, a new app that can transform local murals into original works of art or poetry, and test it out on American Underground's rooftop on the colorful mural by Candy Carver. Registration is required. There is a website shown at American Underground. You check that out if you're in the Durham area. That's June 18th, 5:30 to 8. Then Juneteenth at Oakview. That's a tour of historic Oakview County Park on the outskirts of downtown Raleigh. That's on June 19th, 10:30 in the morning, a walking tour. And it's good that it's in the morning because we're up in the 90-degree temperatures here. Following the tour, you can fold your own wildflower seed packet, illustrative of the steps African-American families took to plant seeds of freedom. Registration is required. Although that is not an admission, you must register for this walking tour at Oakview Historic Oakview County Park, June 19th, 10:30 a.m., Durham, Lyon Park, that's L-Y-O-N, June 19th at 11 to 3. West End Neighborhood presents its second annual event at Carroll Street Park, activities for all ages. North Carolina Association of Public Defenders and the NCCU School of Social Justice host an educational event at the North Carolina Central University in Durham Student Center. There will be a showing of a film, Racist Roots, Origins of North Carolina's Death Penalty, and discussions with guest panelists, June 19th, noon to 4:30 p.m. And then that night, the same night in Durham, 7 p.m., Juneteenth Jamboree, Sarah P. Duke Gardens. Registration is required. Go to Duke Gardens website and look up more. It's a free event outdoors. Singing the Music of Freedom. Celebrate the arts at the Nasher Museum on June 20th. That takes us beyond our broadcast day, broadcast period for this podcast, and so I'll cut short this article here, but you can see how many Juneteenth related items are available for us to attend, and hopefully we'll find a couple of them that we can all get after for this important holiday. After that, we're relatively light on a crucial, important political, educational, electoral articles, and I'll just read what I have in my folder from IndyWeek. First, in Triangle Routes, bus fares. I might have read this before a week ago. I'm not sure. This was written on the 5th of June, but here we go. Go Triangle, that's a regional service. With a fleet of green buses announced, fares will return to its routes starting in the beginning of July. So that's not yet. Go Triangle's routes go from central hubs in Durham, Raleigh, Chapel Hill, and Cary to connect as far west as Mebane, as far east as Zebulon. Riders, if you download the UMO, U-M-O app, will still ride for free throughout July. And Go Triangle buses will still be free for those under 18 or over 65, as well as adults with disabilities or those who qualify for Medicaid, SNAP, or have a low household income. Go Triangle is not all going to be with fares. So many people, many of our listeners, will probably be able to ride those. In Raleigh itself, Go Raleigh buses will start on July 1 collecting fares. Despite some conversations on the city council aimed at addressing the issue, the budget proposal does not include funding to keep that service free. Brawley's transit system was set to run fiscal 2025 with an $8 million deficit. Now, in addition, construction has recently started on Raleigh's buses rapid transit line on Newbern Avenue, which goes downtown and then it goes east, though residents have worried about the gentrification that may come with a zoning change to allow for taller buildings and more housing. But anyway, that's irrespective of that, the buses will likely start collecting fares on July. How about Go Durham? Those lines are set to remain fare-free for at least another year, as long as the ongoing City Council budget negotiations don't come crashing down. Durham Council member Javiera Caballero, at a recent budget work session, said she hoped that higher ridership would help the city meet its climate goals by steering people away from driving their own cars. But Council member Mark Anthony Middleton pointed out the city faces another challenge in getting wealthier and often whiter auto owners to take the bus. I want to keep it fare-free, he says, but I want to keep it fare-free with a cross-section of residents riding it, not just a service for predominantly lower-income black and brown folk. If we're going to truly reduce our carbon footprint, get to where we need to be, has got to be egalitarian. Everybody needs to see it as something they can use. Now, as our respondents to a 2022 survey of Durham bus riders, 77 of those identified as black, 87% lived in households making under $35,000 a year, and 77% did not have access to a car. Finally, Chapel Hill bus their signature Carolina Blue buses have been fare-free for decades, thanks to a partnership between Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and UNC. There are currently no plans to start charging fees, even on the new bus rapid transit line that is currently under development. And in Raleigh, this article by Matthew Junkrowski. With new renovations, downtown Raleigh's Pope House Museum will support more visitors. On South Wilmington Street, one of Raleigh's few bastions of the past stands seemingly frozen in time. The Pope House, rustic brick exterior and aging white paint, looks nearly identical to when it was first built in 1901. But by August, the Pope House will take another step back in time, featuring restorative renovations that staff hope will give visitors a clearer look into Raleigh's black history. To Hazel Boomer, manager at the Pope House, this small house is far greater than its size. She says, "I always say that the house is small but mighty because the ton of history that just exists in this place." Pope House is, in fact, North Carolina's only African-American house museum. While it's currently closed for renovations, during this Juneteenth month, its staff continue their work to share the rich black history of both Raleigh and that family that originally occupied the house. Margaret Domgani, a museum educator at Pope House, says the renovations are an opportunity to improve the museum's programming. Quote, "We're using the renovation as a way to tell this really complicated history, but also take advantage of the fact that this house is still here with all this stuff." Alongside structural renovations, Boomer says the Pope House staff intend to add some important upgrades, including interpretive signage, additional classroom space, and a garden fully stocked with plants that Dr. Manasseh Thomas Pope would have used in his medical practice. Boomer says, "We're expecting to try and find medicinal flowers and herbs. Because we actually found his medical remedies, we would like to incorporate that and use that talk about medicine in the 19th and 20th century. Because we talk about Dr. Pope, we talk about the family, but we don't really talk about what it was like being a doctor and being a black doctor in those times. Additionally, Boomer says new classroom space will help Pope House support more visitors. Quote, in March, we had two large school groups come by and we didn't fit them all in. We broke them up into four groups and had different programming, and that was very successful. But that'll help us host these large school groups and others more often due to some of the space that we will have. The final change to Pope House will be the addition of two rooms formerly closed off to visitors, the Pope bedroom and the kitchen. With these new rooms, Boomer says the museums can display more items from its collection. Dr. Pope built Pope House in 1901. He was not only one of the first licensed black doctors in North Carolina, but one of only seven people of color in Raleigh registered to vote. It was through his right to vote that Pope ran for mayor in 1919, becoming the first black man to do so in the South during the Jim Crow era. He didn't win, but Clarence Lightner, architect, businessman, and the father of Raleigh's first black mayor, Clarence Lightner, who was elected in 1973 later, recalled Pope's historic run. Calvin Lightner said, "We knew we wouldn't win. And if we did win, the whites wouldn't let us administer, but we did it to wake our people up politically." Pope House sits on what was the color line of the Third Ward, which segregated the historically black neighborhood from others around it. Despite how small the house appears today, it was considered a mansion at the time. Boomer says many similar buildings would have surrounded Pope's home, ranging from small businesses and churches to hospitals. Quote, it's very hard to imagine this area had a lot of people living here, but this house represents what was here. During the 1900s, Pope's two daughters, Evelyn and Ruth, preserved the family home, and in 2000, the house was turned into a museum. Robin Herndon, program manager for the City of Raleigh Museum, says the Pope House sets itself apart by showing that people can learn about black history without referencing plantations. Quote, it's so great, really, to tell 100 years of history without really having to reference that. There are so many accomplishments of Dr. Pope and the family and the community that it's just history. Boomer also says the Pope House sets itself apart from other museums this way, saying a lot of black Americans, especially when it comes to media, feel like the only media that kind of represents them when it comes to history is either slavery or the civil rights movement. There's no in between. To Boomer, the Pope House is not just a museum, but a place to uplift black visitors and allow them to connect with black history. Quote, I think of it as a home because, in the larger sense, African Americans have a harder time finding their ancestry due to enslavement. Because you don't have that ancestry, it's very hard to grasp the history. But Pope House represents a physical history, a physical ancestry that I believe all black Americans can connect to. Now, while the Pope House remains closed until August, staff will continue free walking tours of the Third Ward between June 15th, that's coming right up, to August 18th. These will be on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. and on Sundays from 1 to 3 p.m. That's the Pope House. Another article published anyway, on the 7th of June from North Carolina Central University. They will soon have a new chancellor. On Thursday morning, hundreds of community members from undergrads to Golden Eagles, that's alumni who graduated over 50 years ago, as well as distinguished guests from local government boards, commissions, and councils, filled the NC Central Student Event Hall. The Board of Governors appeared via live stream on three large screens hanging from the ceiling. Audience members sat with bated breath and jittery anticipation as they waited to find out who would usher in this new chapter in the school's history. Without much need for deliberation, the board voted unanimously to elect Dr. Carrie G. Dixon as NC Central's 13th chancellor. Dixon, a Winston-Salem native, has over two decades of experience in higher education, much of which she has spent working in the UNC system. During his remarks following the board's vote, UNC system president Peter Hans praised Dixon for, quote, taking on some of the most challenging and rewarding work in all of higher education. In 2018, Dixon was elected Chancellor of Elizabeth City State University, where she oversaw a historic transformation of the school as part of the NC Promise program. Hans said ECSU was in dire straits before she took the helm and elevated the school's academic achievement and reputation throughout the state. Quote, Chancellor Dixon has proven adept at forging strong alliances to benefit her institution. Policymakers from both sides of the aisle sing her praises and appreciate her straightforward, pragmatic approach to addressing North Carolina's needs. Now, Dixon will have the responsibility of leading one of the nation's most acclaimed HBCUs after the current chancellor, Johnson O. Akinleye, announced in January that he was stepping down at the end of the month. Dixon said, I want to thank Chancellor Akinleye for his service in shepherding this institution for 8 years. Your impact on this campus is literally all around us. You set records in everything from infrastructure to enrollment to fundraising. The campus received a major facelift under Akinleye. The university unveiled three new residential halls and a new student center in 2022. Enrollment at the university has also returned to near pre-COVID numbers, with a spike of 400 additional students just between 22 and 23. Hans said, you are leaving your successor a very strong foundation and a great reputation, and that is a genuine gift to this university. James Johnson, Jr., an NCCU alumnus and professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Business School, led the search committee in its quest for a successor starting in February. 50 applicants were whittled down to 8 candidates who the committee interviewed. Only 4 made it to the final round. Johnson says based on search criteria, Dixon seemed the undeniable choice. Quote, when we looked at every one of those items we thought were important to pick to enhance the competitiveness of the region and increase the important role that NC Central has to play in that process, one name kept coming up. I didn't know why it was coming up, but I was happy it was coming up. Dixon officially starts her new position on July 1st. She is charged with overseeing NC Central's growth within the bounds of campus and beyond. The university is adjacent to this historic Hayti district, where Durham city officials have plans to reshape that neighborhood through Hayti Reborn Revitalization Project and a re-imaging of North Carolina 147. Dixon says she believes NC Central can be a strong partner in those initiatives and bring even more to the community. Quote, it's important that we are able to build these relationships that benefit the institution as well as benefit the partners. But what does that look like? I'm excited about the many opportunities in the Triangle and Durham area have for partnerships with business and with our other educational agencies, Durham Tech and Duke University. We should be doing some great work together to continue to elevate the community. There's a lot of rich history here and legacy and traditions. I'm excited about that. All right, next from Durham, the Durham County Budget. This is published June 11th, this article. The Durham Board of County Commissioners passed a budget that included a $20.6 million increase for Durham schools on Monday, receiving a standing ovation from members of the Durham Association of Educators in the audience. The budget gave the school system nearly all the money it had requested, which will pay for raises for teachers and classified staff. Durham schools will additionally receive funding through the American Rescue Plan Act, ARPA, bringing the total DPS allocation to just shy of the school board's $27.5 million request. The increase for the schools was included in an overall county budget of almost $1 billion, $966 million. The amount was $10.3 million over the county manager's recommendation. The budget increases property tax by 4.6 cents per $100 valuation to nearly 80 cents. Following a turbulent year in which DPS administrators decided to rescind salary increases that they could not afford, the new budget will spend $8.8 million on raises for classified staff. The DAE, which mounted an energetic campaign urging commissioners to support the increase, celebrated the decision with a Facebook post that said, "Full funding for our historic DPS budget. Organizing works." The budget passed 4-1, with Commissioner Brenda Howerton as the sole member voting against. "It's my contention," she said, "that the property tax increases by both city and county during the same period is too much to ask our citizens," adding, "There should be an extensive external and internal audit of DPS spending." "Accountability, accountability," said Howerton, who was not re-elected last spring. Howerton was not the only commissioner who expressed qualms with the school board. While she voted in favor of the ordinance, Nimishina Burns, vice chair of the Board of Commissioners, said she distrusts the school leaders. "They have mismanaged money for the better part of the decade, and I need you all to do what you did to me, to them, and put their asses out of office, and I mean that," said Burns, who also lost her bid for re-election in March. Other commissioners said they were happy with the budget. Commissioner Wendy Jacobs choked back tears as she thanked Durham County staff, board, and larger community, said Jacobs. "Budgets are a moral document and a reflection of our values." And the chair, Nida Alam, echoed Jacobs' content. "As my colleagues have said," she said, "tonight is a historic moment in Durham County. We're celebrating the passage of this $966 million budget that speaks volumes about our collective commitment to progress, equity, and community welfare." All right, I'm recording this over the lunch hour, and so I'm interested in reading this longish article about the North Carolina seafood industry. And, of course, when you say seafood, that usually means fish. So I'm all into that, and here I go. Lynn Peterson, the co-founder of Locals Seafood, starts our tour of the company's new East Raleigh market and processing facility by pointing out the fishing village Wanchese on a mural of North Carolina. It is the state's hub for the commercial fishing industry that sits somewhat precariously on the southern end of Roanoke Island. The map isn't detailed. It's a large ocean blue outline of the state that wraps around the corner of the building's market space, unlabeled except for a small dot representing where we are now. Still, Peterson is able to demonstrate the morning's pickups and deliveries on it. Tracing the trajectory of the four trucks active today, the company has eight in total. One truck is in Juan Cheese, waiting on fish that may or may not be coming in from fisher folk who navigate the dangerous Oregon Inlet to get it from the Gulf Stream to the shore. Another truck is picking up mariculture-grown oysters, moving between the 12 family farms that locals works with. A third truck is on its way toward Asheville, and a fourth is taking sheep's head from Raleigh to Oliveira, a Wilmington restaurant. Yes, taking sheep's head back to the coast. As it turns out, thanks to the complications of geography and distribution, there's no other way to get it there. While Peterson is mapping these trajectories, Ryan Speckman, the business's other co-founder, works his phone nearby, finding out what fish came in and from where, buying from his network of fish houses, and moving the trucks around accordingly, and it's all happening in real time. Peterson says, a normal seafood operation would just be Ryan on the market, buying the fish people want, getting tuna 52 weeks of the year from somewhere in the world. The way we do it, Ryan's more like a reporter of what's happening on the coast, like a weather forecaster. This syncopated dance of boats, cell phone texts, and refrigerated trucks is what it takes to be one of the only seafood purveyors 100% focused on North Carolina product. It's been our niche since we started, says Speckman. I don't know if it was intentional design-wise, but the way the map wraps around the room visualizes the problem Peterson and Speckman sought to alleviate when they started Locals Seafood 14 years ago. The coast on one wall, the Piedmont region and western North Carolina on the other. The work of Locals is bringing two back together. That's what these complicated routes do 6 days a week. Reconnect the coast's bountiful harvest to its inland inhabitants. For the uninitiated, prepare for a series of small shocks regarding the state of seafood. Supply chain distribution is all over the map, quite literally. According to a recent New York Times article, 65 to 80% of seafood in the United States is imported, with exports netting around $5 billion a year. The industry is likewise decentralized in North Carolina. Most of the seafood caught off the Tar Heel State's coast is sent north, following already well-established distribution routes. That means the seafood you scarf down at the beach likely isn't from here. And the best place to find North Carolina blue crab might be Maryland. The realization that few folks in the state had access to North Carolina seafood is what inspired Speckman and Peterson to start Locals Seafood in 2010. The two met at NC State University studying fisheries and wildlife science. Over the past decade, they grew the business slowly, expanding from farmers' markets to wholesale distribution services for grocery stores and restaurants. Along the way, they created seafood subscription services in Raleigh, Durham, and Asheville, and opened two retail markets and restaurants, one in Raleigh's Transfer Company Food Hall, which was shuttered in 2022, and another in the Durham Food Hall. Now, the new public-facing market in East Raleigh, which offers a stunning array of fresh and frozen seafood, as well as specialty items like dry-aged bluefin tuna belly and cured mullet roe, has a relatively small footprint in the renovated 10,000-square-foot building. Most of the building services the company's whole fish butchery and seafood processing house. There's room for a potential restaurant, too, but right now, Peterson and Speckman are focused on processing and distribution. The new facility triples locals' capacity to process North Carolina seafood and consolidates its operations close to I-40. Location matters. Once you cut fish, the clock begins ticking. Processing near customers helps. An inland fish house like this market ensures that locals can process and distribute seafood to more distant parts of the states, like Asheville, and still ensure the quality. Biologists and wildlife conservationists emphasize the importance of connectivity, corridors that species can move safely through so they don't get stuck in the sort of isolation that leads to extinction. Locals gives North Carolina seafood a safe passage from its home on the coast to inland parts of the state, even though that path may at times look convoluted, like taking sheep's head fish from the coast to Raleigh, then back again. Centralizing the operations in one place allows suppliers to connect to purveyors and customers across the state. Speckman says as we walk through the massive space, we saw the writing on the wall years ago that really do this correctly, we needed the proper facility. And the proper facility is pretty much this. If seafood had a relationship status, it would definitely be, it's complicated. There are a number of nonprofit watchguard organizations that monitor sustainability nationally, and as far as the state supply goes, many regulations prevent overfishing. John Adlett, a seafood marketing specialist with NC Agriculture and Consumer Services, tells Indy, "Our commercial fishermen are great environmentalists. They want to see the continuation of the species." In 2021, North Carolina's wild-caught seafood industry contributed almost $300 million in value to the state's economy and provided some 5,500 jobs. The state's growing aquaculture industry brings in an annual revenue of $60 million. As a consumer, it can be hard to keep up with what best practices are. Wild caught, farmed, fresh, frozen? Speckman has concerns about both the quality of overseas products and their social and environmental impacts. He says, "We always tell people, if you can't find local seafood, the best rule of thumb is to buy domestic." Of course, thanks to this new market and their presence at areas farmers market and stores, Durham Co-op, the Weaver Street, and as suppliers to restaurant, it isn't as hard as it once was to get local seafood. Just ask Andrea Ruising. The award-winning chef owner of Chapel Hill's Lantern Restaurant loves to tell folks how, when she first moved to North Carolina in 1999 and worked at Vin in Raleigh, she'd drive her station wagon to Tom Robinson's in Carrboro twice a week to get a haul of local seafood. Quote, "There was no east-west distribution of North Carolina fish. When I got NC fish from a purveyor, it would have gone up to the Fulton Fish Market in New York City and then maybe gone down to Atlanta or through Charlotte before coming back. Before Lynn and Ryan started Locals, there was no other way to get local seafood except driving to the coast or maybe getting some through FedEx." Right now, Roising features several items procured through Locals on the Lantern menu. "We have three different kinds of oysters from three different family cultivators. We have wild head-on shrimp and sheep's head, which is one of my favorite fish. It feeds on crustaceans, so it's very rich and nutty." Not only has the Locals helped solve a critical supply chain problem for inland restaurants and consumers, but it's also helping expand an appetite for seafood beyond the familiar standards of shrimp, salmon, and tuna. If you care about seafood sustainability, The best step is to eat a more diverse range of fish. When asked about his relationship with locals' seafood, Ricky Moore, the James Beard Award-winning chef of Saltbox Seafood Joint, responds by emailing over a photo from 2013. It shows him in his trademark floppy fisherman's hat outside the kitchen entrance at Saltbox's original location, signing a receipt with a local's delivery person. There's a refrigerated box and cooler at Moore's feet, and the men are framed by the two companies' vans parked side by side. For Moore, the photo speaks to the nature of a more than decade-long partnership between a restaurant and a vital supplier. He says, "We've got history together. Not too many people were doing it the way I needed it to be done to bring my restaurant concept to life." When Moore first opened Saltbox, he installed a Trust Me board alongside his regular menu of seasonal items to help introduce patrons to less familiar fish species. He said, "In the beginning, when Lynn and Ryan would bring me stuff like sheep's head, people would be like, 'What's a sheep's head?' Only folks who grew up eating stuff would know about it." Moore was happy to find a source that could supply an array of seasonal local fish, and thus a symbiotic relationship between supplier and chef began. "I'd say, 'Bring it to me, man, I'll sell it.' What's being served in most places are things that people are culturally conditioned to eat. Everybody knows what salmon is. It's been marketed to us as health, omega-3s, yada, yada," says Moore. "I like to speak about whole fish. Growing up in eastern North Carolina, we ate a whole lot of whole fish, smaller fish, like croaker and spot. Unless you're regionally connected to it as part of your heritage, you would never see those fish on the menu, and why not? We should be eating them." Moore doesn't need his Trust Me directives anymore, and that's not just due to the slew of awards he's won. "I got my soldiers out there preaching the gospel. My customers are telling folks, 'Yeah, go to Saltbox and try this.'" It's always been more about than just logistics. There's an educational component to learning about local seafood that the lack of crucial infrastructure has only made more pressing. In the case of North Carolina seafood, most of us didn't know all that we were missing out on. When I was growing up in the late 80s and early 90s in Apex, we got our shrimp from a man across the street, from Holt and Sons Auto Repair, who sold them fresh from the coast out of a cooler. In the fall and winter, that same spot was occupied by a different man selling chow chow from his pickup. If a special occasion merited shrimp, my mom knew where to go, just as she knew which farm stand to go to in the summer for fresh corn or squash. The popularity and proliferation of farmers' markets helps, but finding these spots can be a long, often communal process. It's tips from old-timers, trips to local markets and restaurants, and drives spent scanning the streets, circling back to check out a handwritten sign or a curious-looking Quonset hut. Such stomach-led learning takes time. It's something that gets shared through interpersonal connections like generous friends or skilled guides like Moore, who brings it to the table with enthusiasm, knowledge, and trust. There's a reason we don't tell people we don't like where our favorite restaurants are. Not only do we not want run into them, but we don't want to mar the experience of something special with someone who isn't. Locals Seafood's expansion will allow outstanding chefs like Moore and Roising to get the raw materials they need to fuel their creative visions, explore culinary traditions, and preserve cultural heritage. It'll also help ordinary folks like me learn to cook a fish I've never seen before, even though it may have swum past me in a nearby body of water. A patient fishmonger at local's counter can explain what it is and details how to prepare it. Or maybe I'll learn to shuck an oyster or clean a soft-shell crab in one of the market's demo classes. Whatever the case, the story of the species will start to be told just in finding out where it's from and how to eat it. Peterson says, what we really care about is our roots of just getting fish from point A to point B. When you come to us to buy your seafood, you're seeing what's actually happening on our coast. We won't have mahi, but a couple weeks a year because that's when they're catching it off the coast. But we have lots of other fish, he continues, and we can tell those stories, introduce people to something like amberjack, tilefish, black drum, red drum, all those species off our coast that come and go in season. That's what we've been doing for over 14 years at farmers markets. Telling that story, letting folks know, hey, this is something good to try off our coast, and it's a great resource. The expansion also allows the business to tell these fish and shellfish stories to more people in farther reaches of the state, making North Carolina's seafood more accessible. Such infrastructure only becomes more important as word travels regarding the value of what chefs like Moore and Roising have long held as a cherished resource. In other words, once you learn the story of a fish, a sheep's head, say, and get a taste for it, you might be willing to pay more for it next time. Roising says it's kind of ironic that in making underutilized fish more expensive, it might actually protect the fisheries in the future. When the community starts to see, oh, there's value in this, it becomes something that is worth taking care of. I've always been a big proponent of the idea that if we live by a body of water, says Moore, which we do, that has a beautiful, bountiful amount of local species, we should be eating them. Locals was and still is a wonderful partner in making sure we push this idea of North Carolina first in terms of seafood and co-brand North Carolina as not just barbecue, but for seafood. Now, folks, my final article is too long to read in its entirety, but I'll read it nevertheless as far as I can get. For whom the bells toll at Duke Memorial United Methodist Church, everyone. In a hot, dusty room 5 stories above West Chapel Hill Street on Monday evening, Caitlin McDonald stands in front of a massive wooden keyboard and begins to play the bells. McDonald, one of the leaders of the LGBTQ group at Duke Memorial Church, warms up with a brief hymn to mark the 6 p.m. hour, Be Thou My Vision, pushing the chime's 10 wooden levers like the keys of a cumbersome piano, each lever pulling a vertical cable that swings the hammer inside a bell. As she finishes playing from the hymnal, McDonald takes a breath and starts to hammer out a slightly more modern melody on the 116-year-old bells, Hot to Go, the raunchy and ridiculously catchy song by the queer pop star Chapel Roan, spills out of the Romanesque Revival Tower, filling downtown Durham with the sounds of Pride Month. This month, Duke Memorial United Methodist Church racked up around 7 million views on a TikTok posted by a nearby apartment dweller that shows the first time McDonald played Hot to Go on June 1st. Coupled with some behind-the-scenes footage from McDonald herself, it's enough attention to justify calling the 1886 church newly viral. She says, it was very much me just looking forward to Pride Month. I played it because I wanted to, and I thought the city of Durham might enjoy it. And it wasn't just the city that enjoyed it. The bell-ringing TikTok also reached the ears of Kylie Amstutz, who performs at Chapel Roan, and who is, as it happens, stopping by Raleigh on June 12th as part of her Midwestern Princess Tour. My jaw dropped, Amstutz told Indy in an audio recording sent over email. The pop star from Springfield, Missouri, and has said she grew up Christian and believing that gay was a sin, has been outspoken about her queer identity and support of LGBTQ community. In recent weeks, she's used her platform for political advocacy, even turning down an invitation to perform at a pride event at the White House. She said to the camera, while dressed as the Statue of Liberty at a concert in New York, "We want liberty, justice, and freedom for all. When you do that, that's when I'll come." That means freedom in trans rights. That means freedom in women's rights. And it especially means freedom for all oppressed people in occupied territories. Amstutz told Indy she was excited to hear the song played in a church. "I haven't been that shocked in probably ever. For the first time, it felt like my song was within the culture. For the first time ever. Obsessed." While it was unconventional to play on church bells, McDonald knew she had the support of church leadership. Duke Memorial in recent years has been on the progressive side of the denomination-wide turmoil over LGBTQ policy. In 2020, the lead pastor, Heather Rodriguez, made headlines as one of 12 clergy members who presided over Duke Memorial's first gay wedding in an act of holy disobedience, as same-sex couples were not yet allowed to get married in the United Methodist Church. Other groups have been at the center of tension in Durham. There was Pioneers Church, a church and coffee shop, closed its doors after receiving pushback. And in 22, Pioneers Church left the UMC. They're not the only ones. Since 2019, nearly a third of North Carolina's UMC churches have disaffiliated, leaving a more progressive group, including Duke Memorial, to steer doctrine in a more inclusive direction. And if you're interested in hearing this full story, you can go to indieweek.com and search it out. It is available. And my theme music is now telling me I've got to go away. And I'll be back next week with another issue. Well, actually, I might not be for the next week, but following that, John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service saying so long, and thank you very much for listening to our programming.